Welcome to the InvestSense podcast, where we try and make sense of what's happening in markets and help you help your clients invest. In this podcast, we talk to Tassos Tassopoulos, portfolio manager at Trinetra Investment Management, an emerging market specialist that we use quite widely. He's a good guy to chat to about markets in general, but we reached out to him specifically because he allows us a great deal of transparency into his underlying holdings. And amongst the managers that we monitor, we noticed that he was one of the first to start to go bargain hunting amongst the most beaten out stocks we're seeing out there. So we start with a discussion on the impact of values, something he has become quite well known for in Australia through his keynote addresses at the Portfolio Construction Forum, and specifically how that is affecting responses to the COVID-19 virus around the world. But then the conversation quickly goes into the down and dirty business of hard-headed, sometimes contrarian stock picking, which he is perhaps less well known for. During the discussion, I actually inadvertently misquote a phrase that you might have heard before, "You're a braver man than I, Gunga Din," from a Rudyard Kipling poem about an underappreciated Indian water carrier in late 1800s British colonial era. I kept the misquote, it should be, "You're a better man than I, Gunga Din," as the title of this podcast, as I think it speaks to the underappreciated role of active managers and the stress associated with managing money in the often confusing environment of even the last few years, especially for a fundamental investor, but especially in the latest crisis over the last few weeks. As a house, we think markets are full enough to present opportunities, so we're in a bit of a holding pattern, but we haven't yet found the courage and conviction to jump in wholeheartedly on behalf of our clients. For that reason, we are grateful to have managers like Tassos on the front line, moving perhaps a little quicker than we can. You may also pick up on the fact that we do like to build a collaborative relationship with fund managers. Some might sensibly wonder whether this makes it more difficult to go one separate ways when paths inevitably diverge. And certainly when the dust settles, there might be some difficult conversations. But for now, we hope this conversation shows why, for the most part, the pros of working closely with our investment partners tends to outweigh the potential costs. Now lastly, you may note that Tassos is very careful not to mention any actual stock names, lest they be construed as investment recommendation. That's for compliance reasons, but in fact, it's also the whole point of this conversation. People like Tassos are making these difficult decisions so we don't have to. In that sense, this is information only, which is general in nature and not specific to your circumstances. If you're a retail investor, that means don't try this at home, as they say on the TV, and maybe talk to a financial advisor before making any market calls of your own. Whether or not these stock calls turn out to be right or wrong, we'll only know with hindsight, but we certainly feel that the intent is right and that Trinetra are following their own process. Besides, it makes a refreshing change to be having a positive discussion about investments and the future, at least while markets are still closed. Tassos, good morning in the UK. Thanks very much for making some time, especially during your weekend. So just look, before we get into the investments, how's London? In Sydney, we feel we're just before something. Obviously, there's going to be some kind of a lockdown, but it hasn't quite happened yet. Everyone's starting to take it quite seriously. What's going on in London?
Well, I haven't been into the office for 2 weeks. So 2 weeks ago, as you know, I have young kids, and I thought one of the things we can really not afford to have is any of the investment team to get sick. We need to have our brains working fully in this type of markets. So we basically separated and everybody's working independently from home. Now, we're not seeing what the situation you're seeing in other countries. So, for example, I know from my parents in Cyprus, they're limiting the people that can get in a supermarket. People cannot come within 2 meters of each other. So when you're standing in a checkout queue, there's 2 meters distance between you. Here, people are congregating. It seems that at the beginning, up to even recently, the people were still going to the pubs and not taking this extremely, extremely seriously. But the government is trying to crank down on this and try to get people to understand that this is something they have to take more seriously. And I think as the news are coming out that some of the hospitals are running out of bed capacity, and with some of the news coming out of Italy, people will wake up to the fact that they have some responsibility here to stop the transmission of this disease.
Yeah, it's interesting because we look at the country level data like everyone else, and I guess it's interesting. There's the data, but you've also got to understand the nuances between different countries, and the responses are not, it's not like the GFC where everyone got together and said this is going to be the approach. It doesn't seem like we're at that stage yet. There's different things going on in different countries.
Right, actually, Jonathan. I mean, and one of the things that we are thinking about a lot when we do these ethnographic studies is people will behave in accordance to their values. And when we looked at the WHO data, and especially for China, one of the things that people came back and were saying, yes, but that is an autocratic system. You can, it's almost a dictatorship. You can tell people and they will obey. And that is absolutely not true when it comes to the Chinese people. If that was true, they would never have had the melamine scandal, right? So we have done ethnographic studies. We have actually done a study in Wuhan about 5 years ago. And I can tell you the difference with Chinese people and people in the UK is that when the Chinese people we met speak about getting sick and going to hospital, they view that as a very risky proposition. They end up going at 3 o'clock in the morning to get in the queue. The misdiagnosis rate is very high, not because the doctors are not good, but because they don't have a GP, which basically acts as a gatekeeper and sends you to the right doctor. So you go to the wrong specialist for whatever is the expression for to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and then misdiagnose you. So what we found from Chinese is that they do a couple of things. They do a lot of preventive healthcare, which is in the form of exercise and taking vitamins and supplements, because they know they don't want to get to a hospital. So when you think about the values of the Chinese, they would have acted because they don't view their system, I will get sick, it will fix me. When I'm having discussions in the United Kingdom, and I'm sure it's in the developed world, we view as the healthcare system as able, we break it, oh, these doctors will fix us. And I think this is completely wrong. Even yesterday, I was hearing some nonsense from somebody who was telling me, oh, they have these amazing ECMO machines. This is a form of ventilator that basically extracorporeal membrane oxygenation machines. And apparently they're amazing in the NHS and they will save our lives. That, Jonathan, is a complete myth, like a lot of these stories that are going around. There is the data we have out of China. And basically, anybody who goes on an ECMO machine, you're basically knocking on death's door. And in the data from that came out of the academic studies of Wuhan for January, anybody who went on an ECMO machine died. It's not going to save your life. And I think the Chinese are better at understanding that. When you look at different countries, I understand Mediterranean culture, and I can tell you those are cultures of honor and shame. I don't think there will be anything more shameful than you taking the disease home and killing off your mother. So I do think that the Southern Europeans will behave in the right way quickly to protect their families because of those cultures. I've never done a study in the United Kingdom or the United States. I cannot offer a view of that. But that's one element that we don't pick up in the statistics.
That's really interesting, because what you're saying is, because the whole world is looking at the difference between the experience of Hubei and South Korea and Italy and saying growth rates of above 10%. If that continues for long, then some of these really big numbers, 80% of the population, the really big death rates, what you're saying is that there's a cultural element to this that might surprise people.
Yes. And I think what people are saying is, oh, yes, the Italians don't listen to authority. They're not like the obedient Chinese. It's completely wrong. In the Italian culture, which is the same as the Cypriot and the Greek and the Spanish culture, it's not a shame for you to cheat the government. In the old days, maybe now cultures are changing, but you are brave to, and you're the smart guy when you cheat the tax. But you cheat your family, everybody ostracizes you. It's not acceptable. You cannot cheat your friends. That's bringing dishonor. And I think it's very different to cheat the government from killing a member of your family because you transmitted the disease. You got away with it and you had minor symptoms while your parents or your uncle died. So that's why I think Italian data and Spanish data will start coming down. What I see from the WHO data is that they were probably very slow at diagnosing it. And actually, it's, the WHO data, I've been approaching this, Jonathan, is that, and I think I think in one of your newsletters, you will phrase it much better than me, market movements don't give you information, right? Do not react to market movements. You will panic. You need to react to data. And I'll let you tell me what the exact quote is, what that was in your newsletter. So for us, I don't want to hear stories from people who's heard from a friend who is a doctor. I look at the WHO data And then I look at a very small number of experts, like, you know, Professor Gabriel Leung from Hong Kong University. He knows what he's talking about. I kind of trust after watching him time after time, and I listen to these people. And by the way, one of the things that I want to thank you is about this WHO data. As you know, we had a discussion a few weeks ago, and I was telling you how I was spending all these hours taking from the WHO the data, and I was moving them to Excel with a team, and we were doing text to columns, and it was a lot of hours every day. And I was getting worried about our ability to analyze the data as more and more countries was going to come in, because it was taking us so many hours. And your team had figured a way I can't remember where it was, you got it from GitHub, and you automated the spreadsheets, and you've given us now a model that Shantanu in our team from India, in the morning, presses a button, downloads all the latest data on your spreadsheet, and then we translate that in all these charts. So I get about 5:30 every morning. I have all my charts ready now with so many countries where the data has exploded, where before it was taking 3 to 4 hours in the morning before we had the first data to look at what the latest cases were showing.
That's very kind of you to mention it. And actually, credit should go to Dan, our analyst, for figuring that one out quite early on. But that actually goes to the heart of what we're doing here, is we want to collaborate with managers, better outcome for clients. Sounds cute, but it's actually what we're doing. And it's actually why I reached out to you tonight. We're in a kind of holding pattern. We came in kind of cautious. We've been holding a few volatility hedges, gold, stuff like that, which obviously hasn't been wonderful over the last few years. But now, like a lot of people, we're in the kind of holding period. We don't want to go, markets have re-rated by 30%. We don't want to jump in feet first. But you're the first manager. And actually, just to specify, it's a Benjamin Graham quote that you pointed out there, that the market's there to serve us, not to guide us. That said, because we're not quite as close as you, we're in some ways not quite ready to jump in feet first. We get your portfolio. It's very transparent. We can see it up on Bloomberg. We can see what you're doing. And the reason why I reached out was seeing you buy a South American airline last week. My first thought was, well, there's a braver man than I, Gunga Din, if you remember the Rudyard Kipling quote. That's not something I feel ready to do, but you've already started buying, you're initiating positions in the market in quite risky things, I'd say.
Okay. So the way we see the portfolio is that every day you're effectively choosing to buy the same portfolio. So you making no change, you're effectively deciding to buy that same portfolio like it was, and not to even rebalance your portfolio. Now, I wish I was as brave. If I was brave, it would have been a much bigger increase in the position I would have taken. But the way we've been seeing it is as follows. You have a massive correction. We had one stock, which we talked in the past about, which was a healthcare company in China that had basically doubled in this period. That's the starting point. And when you looked at it, when we were originally buying it, we had a massive risk adjusted returns, and the stock doubles, but we cannot understand why in this period this stock would be so strong, because ultimately this company makes cardiovascular stents, it makes orthopedic, which are hip replacements. If you look at the United Kingdom, all elective surgeries have gone out of the window. It's a great company, but we cannot find a way to come up with a justification. We are running out of risk-adjusted returns. What we thought that the company was going to do in 3.5 years, it did it basically in 3 months. And the only thing we can think that could be justifying it is that a few years ago they did an acquisition, and they could have, within these acquisitions, there is potential that there is a small division that is making heart and lung ventilators, and maybe the market is getting excited with that. We are not even sure. It doesn't even show in our numbers. We even would question if they have that, if that came within the acquisition. So we have a stock that doubled in a market correcting, and we took all the profits. So we need to think, where are we going to get the best risk-adjusted return to apply that cash? I I'm getting paid to be an active manager. I'm not getting paid to sit on cash. When we look at airlines, Andy and our team has covered airlines for 20 years. And he always says that when you see an airline correct between 50 and 70%, the market is telling you that it's pricing in that it's going to go bust, right? So we need to figure out if it's going to go bust or not. The analysis we did to make this decision was that, okay, we need to see how much runway they have with their cash. Nothing else matters. And this airline has about 2.8 billion of cash. We then looked at how much cash were they burning in October. And they were burning about 400 million. 280 million goes on their lease payments. 120 million was their salary cost. Those are the real costs. Everything else you're not paying because you're now grounding fleet. Now, based on this, we have 7 months before this company runs off cash. And you can run quite pessimistic scenarios. When we started analyzing it, what we've seen is a couple of things. Number one, this company has got 4 months of lease holiday, so that they would save 280 million every month. On top of that, the 120 million they paid in the labor cost, there is two factors that will affect it. Number one, when you're flying, you're still paying effectively bonuses for people to fly, and you would save that money. So maybe the labor cost is down to 100. And the Brazilian government announced that they will allow them to cut their salaries down to half by 50%. So really the burn rate is about 50 million over the next 4 months. So the cash of this company will go from 2.8 down to 2.6. If nobody else gives us any other discount, nothing, we have 11 months before we run out of cash. If the government allows them to keep the salaries at those levels instead of firing these people, which makes sense for the government, you've got 13 months. If the leasing companies allow them a holiday indefinitely, given that the planes are not flying and they can't give them anywhere else if they pick them up, you've got 56 months. So is there a chance that it goes bust? Of course, but the market shouldn't be knocking the stock down by 90% plus, because the potential for us on the upside is asymmetric now, because things can always go worse, but I don't see when you run these numbers. And this is the type of analysis you need to do. You run your analysis, then the managements are very happy to speak to you and you say, this is what I'm doing in my numbers. This is how I see it. And this is the time for you to be an active manager. This is what the clients are paying you for. Do this analysis and make an informed decision. There's no certainty in these markets, no matter how you see it. But on the balance of this is a bet we should be making, because when it gets like to the lows it hit this week, you have a potential, if it returns back to where it was, the stock is going to grow tenfold. So do you want to take this bet? I'm telling you how long it's going to take before they burn it. And I can tell you there's another factor that you're not accounting. The airlines who are not as well capitalized are likely to go bust before them. So when things return, they'll be in a stronger position. And that's why it made sense to do that, even though it looks like a death wish.
We're seeing in the local market Qantas down by 2/3. You think if it survives, which it probably will, that's a big difference. 90% for something that's probably money good at the end of this. Yeah, like I said, I'm glad that you're in the market doing these kind of things. Are there other industries where you can apply that thinking? And specifically, where governments have said that they're actually going to mitigate some of this risk, is that an opportunity for you?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a really important point. So if you look, for example, in the discretionary space, look at the restaurant business, okay? And let's not talk about anything specific, but if you look at the restaurant business, what you have is some of these restaurant companies will struggle in the next few months because they're shutting down. So what the reaction of the market is, let's say you run a restaurant business, you have a net debt to EBITDA of 3x, and you have a covenant at, let's say, 4x. So the market turns around and says, you're going to breach your covenant. So, oh my God, this is a disaster, and the stock collapses 70%. Well, let's assess what's going to happen, because some people will say, oh, is it going to breach it? Is it going to not going to breach it? It will breach it. But I think it's an irrelevancy that it will breach the covenant, because the covenant is there to make sure you don't get over leveraged, not because your EBITDA will collapse in the short term. So lots of brokers putting out notes saying, oh, I think the EBITDA will go to 5. It's irrelevant. It could go to infinity if, as we're approaching 0 in the profitability for these years. These are extraordinary times. The proper work you need to do is, again, look at what cash they have and look what is the split between fixed and variable costs. And then you need to use your knowledge and experience as an analyst, because you will have this information to create a simple model that you can work from and then go and have this type of discussions with management. So let's use this example of a restaurant. If you think of a restaurant that has a revenue of 100, Jonathan, half your money will go on to labor and food. So labor will be about 30, food will be about 20. Then you're going to pay 10 for rent and 10 for your equally between energy, marketing, and the royalty for your brand. And that will take you roughly to 70 for cost, and 30 is your EBITDA. So if you use the example I was giving you before, your debt would be at 90. And you, before we would say, oh, you could leverage up to 120. But actually at the moment, what you're seeing is this EBITDA come down. But what, to be able to estimate, you need to figure out what costs are fixed and what costs are variable. And typically, what we would have said is that the costs that are fixed are your labor costs, your rent, your energy, your marketing expenses. But this, and you could say, okay, and that's 45% of my cost. That is completely wrong in this type of market. Why? First of all, if you look at, let's say this restaurant is in Spain, the government has said that through ERTE is going to pick up all your labor costs. Don't fire the people. We will pick up 30% of your revenues, which is your labor cost. We're picking it up. You're not selling any food. Your energy, if the restaurants are shut, you don't have an energy bill. What's the point of doing any advertising? The marketing will go down to zero now. So when you sit and analyze this cost base, really the only cost that is actually fixed is about 9%, which is the rent you pay. And now you're seeing the French government and discussions in the US whether they say you cannot evict anyone. And I'm sure the guys who are leasing you the space, and especially if you're in malls and you're working with developers and have a long-term relationship, they know that you're not having any revenues. There will be some negotiation. So you go and look at these businesses and you might think, okay, at the current rate with all these costs, maybe they have enough money at some stage in the second half. But actually, your calculation of what costs are fixed and what are variable is wrong. And what you need is to do this fundamental analysis. And then you go to pick up the phone and speak to those managements. And it's not just to make sure your numbers make sense, but you have another role. In these markets, those managements are seeing in 2 days their stock price on very low volumes drop by half. And they might not know the Benjamin Graham quote, but what we need to tell them is a very simple thing. Don't do things that in 6 months you will be ashamed that you have done. Don't turn around when the government is paying the salaries and start firing people left, right, and center, because the labor cost is not an issue anymore. And they're seeing their employees say to them, let's open up again for delivery. There's people who cannot cook. Let's open up for delivery when the 2 weeks, you know, that the businesses are shut, and let's do this. And that's the message you need to be giving to managements as well. We talk about, you know, sustainable investing. That's our role, to think about this and not to panic and make managements panic, because we are long-term investors. Now, there is another important thing I want to flag as Jonathan in this period about being long-term investors. And long-term investor doesn't mean buy liquid positions on a 5-year view. And in this downturn that liquidity is disappearing, I think it is right that you guys are not touching some of the things that are less liquid. For us, 96% of the portfolio can be sold assuming a 20% participation of the market today. That is a very, liquidity is something really important that we need to consider in these times.
Look, that's great. I'm really glad I reached out, because people are worried, and we have an inkling that prices have got to a level. You know, maybe there's an S&P 1700 or 1900 out there, but over the next 10 years, we're going to be able to make money out of some of the things that the market is offering up to us. We just don't know the how and the when. It's also a good conversation to have, because everyone's reading the same stuff, getting worried about their personal lives, about their finances, and to know that there's something we can do about it. And some of our managers are actually starting to get a little bit positive about them, that the market. Am I reading that wrong? Is your outlook as an investor fundamentally okay?
I just see that there is really great opportunities. There is a stables company, one of the biggest and best stables companies in the world, that was trading this week 5 standard deviations below its 5-year P average. Now, what we've been doing in all these companies to make this move, to look at our numbers, we go back and say, okay, let's look at what's happening in China. If we apply it to every country in the world, how much do we take off our earnings? And let's look at those depressed earnings and then assume that it creates a basis. And like, we cannot really kill the numbers on a stables company that much.
We're watching the portfolio. I know that because of European regulations and how you sort of transmit advice, we're not allowed to say what it is. But I think listeners would be really interested to understand just how mainstream, how stable, and you know what a household name that company is. And you've been able to buy again at a 30% discount.
Yeah, you buy that 30% discount, and we turn around and say, you know, could you go more? Yes, I'll buy a bit more. Because at the end of the day, people still need to buy soaps. People still need, you know, to use shampoos and in this period, and people are still going to eat mayonnaise. You know, I mean,
people are going to guess what it is, and your compliance team are going to be up in arms. Now, that's great. So fundamentally, as an investor, you can look through this crisis. You're starting to get optimistic at a price level, at least.
I want to, it's not about being optimistic, Jonathan. It's about doing your role. And here is the big difference. And this is what I think is very different from every other crisis we faced. In the GFC, what happened was you're waking up in the morning and you are worried about your client's money in this market. And you're also worried about your job. Yeah, I remember thinking, oh my God, what if my whole team lets go and we shut down the product gets shut down, and what will happen, and will they find jobs? Will we find jobs in this downturn? There are so many people unemployed. In this downturn, it's very different. I wake up in the morning, and of course, I'm worried about my family's health. I have parents who are quite old. I have young kids. I have loved ones that could be in risk groups. So this time we're feeling we have this worry about our personal safety, which is not a great psychological position to look at the markets when they are collapsing. But my attitude has been, on these stocks that we've done work on, and we know, you know the dates we've traded, the dates that the markets has collapsed, we stepped in and bought on those collapses. And that is when I'm trading and I feel like I want to throw up, and we talked about this, that I had to stand up and go and put my running shoes and went on those days. I've run 10 kilometers each of those days to clear my head, no music, no podcast to listen to, just the sound of my shoes hitting the street to just clear my head. And for me, what I've been doing is, we talked about this before. Every night I write a journal for 15, 20 minutes to basically keep myself honest about why I make decisions. And I find myself writing 3 times a day, even more. And the way I see it, nobody will ever read my journal, but maybe my kids one day. And I want them to see that when there was this huge crisis in the market, how I behaved and how I did what I thought was the best I could do for the clients, which is remain rational. Don't overreact. Look at all the information that I had to the best of the knowledge. Do the analysis as deep as I could. Try to engage with management. Try to act like we are grown-ups here and try and give the right advice to them. And, you know, try to partner with everyone. And even the engagements we're doing with you, I try to speak to you and you speak to me, and so that we try and get through this together and make the best decisions we can, even though the information might be limited and it's uncertain.
And I think that point about psychology, so look, you know, I know you well enough. I don't think you'd mind me saying you are a warrior, and that can be an asset in the investment world. You turn over every stone. But the fact that you're willing to invest with the rational part of your brain is also important. But also, I think it speaks to the work that you've been doing with Graham Rich and Portfolio Construction Forum on phenology and investor behavior. This is kind of what we're aspiring to, no?
Exactly. I mean, the work that Graham Rich has been doing with phenology, there is nothing that is more perfect to help you with, because what he's been lecturing is that you need to understand your psychology. You need to understand the psychology of your investors to be able to make the rational decisions. And there isn't a time that it was necessary in the GFC, but even this time is even more critical, because you cannot allow your fear and your behavioral biases push you to make decisions that in the future you will regret, when the information and you could have made better decisions at the time. And you need to remain sane. Just keep working. Yeah, you know, I write with fountain pens. I feel a fountain pen. I think, just write until I run out of ink. What is happening with this company? What's the story? Are we right? What is wrong? What can go wrong? And you know, you're right. I'm a warrior. We do pre-mortems for everything. I assume that this has failed and I need to prove it. And it's the story we talked about, the airline. What do I have to make this airline fail? And that's what we're trying to do.
No, look, that's great. And when I said at the outset that we were going to do this in 15 minutes, knowing you, I probably should have realized that was ambitious. But it's half an hour, really well spent, great insights. And we're in the middle of the weekend. We've got another day or so before markets throw something else outrageous at us. It certainly calmed my nerves. So thank you for that.
I want to say, Jonathan, and the people to survive this, they need to say it's going to get worse before it gets better. Don't be an optimist. And I'm not an optimist. I'm trying to find the relative opportunities here to move into. And there is a, for people who read Good to Great, there is a thing called the Stockdale paradox. And they should Google it and look it up. Stockdale was, I read the book a while ago, I think it was the highest ranking naval officer who was taken prisoner in the Vietnam War. And when they asked him who didn't make it, he said, the optimist. The people who thought, oh, it's going to turn around tomorrow, we are going to be released by Christmas, and Christmas came and it didn't, it was going to happen by Valentine's Day, and it didn't happen for a while. The people who survived were the ones who realized the enormity of the situation, they were realized, but they have an unquestionable belief that they were going to get through it. And I think we're going to get through this. This is not going to end up civilization. We know what the numbers are. We know what the mortality rates are. But just be realistic. Do your fundamental work. There isn't a better time to be a fundamental analyst. That's what we get paid. Just do the fundamental analysis. Work through these times and your numbers, and make the best decisions you can at this moment.
Now, great. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate your work. And the more I think about it, that Gunga Din quote is probably quite apt. It just came out, but it's about people doing the hard yards, and active fund managers in this market, you're doing the hard yards. Much appreciated. And if it's okay with you, I think we'll talk again very soon.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for taking the time today.